While in Egypt, Jeannot befriended the leaders of the Algerian National Liberation Front, FLN, who were fighting to free their country from French colonial rule. His financial acumen and political connections made him a valuable asset to the Arab revolutionaries. As Erna Paris has pointed out, he created an import-export firm called Arabo Africa to deliver weapons to the FLN, set up the Arab Commercial Bank in Switzerland, and manage the FLN's war chest until Algeria gained its independence in 1962. 2 years later, Jeannot and the FLN had a major falling out, and for the next 15 years they battled in Swiss courts for control of a $15 million FLN Swiss bank account until the money was returned to Algeria. At the height of the Algerian War in the late 1950s, Jeannot first met Jacques Vergès. The Algerian resistance held great emotional appeal for Vergès, who fought the battles of the Third World through his legal practice. One of his most famous clients, Jamila Bouhired, Bouhired, whose story is immortalized in the film of The Battle of Algiers, had been arrested for bombing a milk bar frequented by Europeans in Algiers. When Bouhired stood trial in 1957, Vergès never denied the charges against her. Instead, he introduced what he called the strategy of disruption, unquote, which was to become his legal trademark and earn him celebrity status in France. The French colonialists were the real criminals, Vergès argued, and should be indicted for countless atrocities. Bouhired laughed out loud in court when the death sentence was pronounced. Her punishment was later commuted to life in prison, and she was freed the same year the French withdrew from Algeria. Vergès used the strategy of disruption earlier this year when he defended George Ibrahim Abdallah, the 36-year-old leader of the Lebanese Armed Revolutionary Faction. Abdallah, formerly a member of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, was convicted for the 1982 murders in Paris of an American military attaché and an Israeli embassy official. Abdallah used the forum of the courtroom to denounce American imperialists and their Zionist guard dogs like Bouhired. He laughed when he learned of his sentence, life in prison. To this day, Vergès is determined never to let the French forget their brutal role in Algeria, and he intends to raise the issue once again in defending Klaus Barbie. 1 million Algerians were killed by the French, he says. If you want to judge Barbie, then you must also judge yourself.
After Algerian independence in 1962, Vergès moved to Algiers, converted to Islam, changed his name to Jacques Mansour, M-A-N-S-O-U-R, and in 1963 married his former client, Jamila Bouhired. The couple went to China for their honeymoon and, according to Erna Paris, were, quote, cordially received by Chairman Mao. Vergès returned to Algeria a full-fledged Maoist. Given his passionate commitment to Arab nationalism, few were surprised when Vergès authored a book extolling the Palestinian cause entitled For the Fedayeen. After Israel defeated the Arabs in 1967, a mood of desperate militancy swept through the misery-ridden Palestinian refugee camps. With Palestinians deprived of a homeland since 1948 and faced with an enemy that had spurned repeated offers to negotiate, the Palestine Liberation Organization decided to escalate its tactics. Yasser Arafat's Al-Fatah, the most powerful group under the PLO umbrella, joined other Palestinian groups in seeking aid from non-Arab sources, including the Soviet Union. The Soviets responded cautiously, while China began sending sizable arms shipments. The arms from Beijing were not enough, though, to sustain a protracted military struggle. PLO leaders felt they couldn't afford to turn down any offers of help, no matter how unsavory the donors. Here, François Jeannot and his neo-Nazi colleagues sprang into action. In April 1969, the New European Order, a Lausanne-based neo-Nazi umbrella organization, met in Barcelona. According to Le Monde correspondent Jean-Claude Bourrer, who is the world's leading Jeannot watcher, Jeannot played a role in planning the event, which attracted 50 delegates from Europe and Latin America, as well as a representative from Al-Fatah. Several delegates pledged to assist the PLO by supplying money, men, and training. After the conference, Jeannot began selling weapons to various Palestinian factions and advising them on how to invest the large sums of money that were pouring in. His closest relations were with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a far-left faction led by Dr. George Habash, which jumped into the headlines around the world in the late 1960s by hijacking several commercial jets. Three of Habash's men were captured during an attack on an El Al airplane in Zurich in February 1969. According to a 1984 documentary, The Other Face of Terror, when the case was tried later that year, François Jeannot helped pay their legal costs. Throughout the proceedings, he sat next to the defendants and conferred with their legal advisor, his old friend Jacques Vergès. The first public alliance between the old guard Nazi banker and the brilliant anti-colonialist lawyer was a concrete premonition of the slogan the third position would adopt several years later. Hitler and Mao were indeed united in struggle.
Within days after the PFLP members were convicted in February of 1970, Jacques Vergès dropped completely out of sight. Just as suddenly, he reappeared in Paris 8 years later. "I stepped through the looking glass," he says in Unhealed Wounds, "where I served an apprenticeship." His apprenticeship over, Vergès resumed his law practice in Paris and in 1982 took on a new case with a Jeannot connection. Vergès represented, unsuccessfully as it turned out, two members of the clandestine organization run by Carlos, the infamous Venezuelan terrorist. Bruno Breguet, a Swiss citizen who had worked with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and Magdalena Kopp, an ex-member of the West German left-wing Baader-Meinhof group, had been accused of plotting to blow up a busy café on the Champs-Élysées. Breguet professed to be a left-wing revolutionary, but he was a longtime friend of François Jeannot. When Breguet was captured during a PFLP bombing mission in Israel in 1970 and sentenced to a 15-year jail term, Jeannot organized a successful campaign to have him freed after 7 years. In the early 1980s, Vergès continued to display his political ambidexterity. He began editing a journal of armed resistance, unquote, called Correspondance Internationale, which published lengthy communiques from imprisoned comrades, unquote, of the Italian left brigades and other left-wing terrorist groups. He took on as a client Frédéric Aurillac, a member of the Paris-based Direct Action, a far-left group that had attacked Jewish targets in France to protest the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. And he granted a sympathetic interview to a Spanish neo-Nazi magazine, which was reprinted in Cobra, a newsletter for right-wing political prisoners in the United States and Europe, published by the Paris-based European National Fascists, or FNE. In the fall of 1980, the FNE machine-gunned 5 Jewish cultural buildings in Paris and claimed responsibility for bombing the Rue Copernic synagogue, an attack that killed 4 and wounded 24. For more on the French ultra-right, see Lord of the Books, page 53. While Vergès was pursuing his mysterious apprenticeship between 1970 and 78, François Jeannot continued to use the Palestinians to further his own anti-Jewish agenda. In Geneva, Jeannot became friendly with Ali Hassan Salameh, the leader of Black September, the organization that murdered 9 Israeli athletes at the 1972 Olympics in Munich. When Salameh needed medical attention, Jeannot arranged for him to be treated at a private clinic in Lausanne. In 1974, PLO chief Yasser Arafat denounced international terrorism and declared his commitment to seeking a negotiated settlement, establishing a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. These steps toward moderation, which were strongly supported by the Soviets, triggered the schism that persists today within the PLO, as George Habash's Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and a host of Syrian, Libyan, and Iraqi-based factions ruled out any compromise with Israel. A bloody internal conflict began pitting Arafat loyalists against members of the so-called Rejectionist Front.
Not surprisingly, Jeannot and his neo-Nazi colleagues favored those Arab groups calling for the annihilation of the Jewish state. But Jeannot's erstwhile friend, Ali Hassan Salameh, aligned himself with the Arafat forces. As al-Fatah's security chief, Salameh repudiated his former terrorist activities and began warning Western intelligence services, including the CIA, of plots by rival Palestinian groups. Salameh also shared information with European governments regarding links between their own domestic terrorists and Arab extremists. In January 1979, Salameh was assassinated by an Israeli hit squad in Beirut, presumably as revenge for his earlier role with Black September. Whatever the real motive, his death served to undermine the position of moderates in the PLO as well as in Israel, while bolstering the hardliners in both camps, including the Israeli leadership who, in the words of former Prime Minister Menachem Begin, viewed the Palestinians as, quote, two-legged animals, unquote, worthy of extinction. Among the hardliners in the Arab camp is the Palestine Liberation Front, PLF, a Tunis-based organization headed by Mohamed Abu Abbas. Abbas is best known for masterminding the Achille Lauro hijacking in 1985, much to the embarrassment of Yasser Arafat. Although news of the Achille Lauro incident was splashed widely across U.S. newspapers and beamed nightly via television into U.S. living rooms, the major U.S. news media never reported an intriguing part of the story. Included on the PLF's list of prisoners to be exchanged for the Achille Lauro hostages was the name of Otfried Hepp, H-E-P-P, then one of West Germany's most wanted neo-Nazi terrorists. Quote, "I know Hepp quite well," Abbas told the French Daily Liberation in 1985. "He is a friend. I do not consider him to be a Nazi. On the contrary, he is a militant anti-imperialist and anti-Zionist and a supporter of the Palestinian cause." The 28-year-old Hepp was arrested in Paris on April 8, 1985, while entering an apartment inhabited by a leading member of the PLF. He was convicted of possessing weapons and false identification papers and was extradited earlier this year to West Germany, where he has been charged with organizing a series of bombings against U.S. military bases.
Hepp's saga as a terrorist began in the late 1970s when he underwent paramilitary training with the neo-Nazi Hoffmann Group at a castle near Nuremberg. The Hoffmann Group, which had participated in joint maneuvers with neo-Nazis from several European countries, was banned after police raided the castle in February of 1980 and seized a huge cachet of explosives, automatic weapons, uniforms, poisonous chemicals, anti-aircraft guns, and a tank, all supplied by sympathizers inside the West German Army. Later that year, a Hoffmann graduate blew himself up while planning a bomb at Munich's Oktoberfest celebration. A final body count of 11 dead and 200 injured made it the worst terrorist incident in post-war Germany. Hepp was briefly imprisoned in 1981 for distributing Nazi propaganda and inciting racial hatred. While in jail, he sent a letter to Berlin's leftist newspaper, Die Tageszeitung, bitterly denouncing the United States. "The minds and souls of people here in the West are in the process of stultification," said Hepp, whose letter ended, quote, "forward in the anti-imperialist struggle." In a prison interview with Die Welt, he added, "We think everyone is justified in this struggle. We only have a chance if the rightists and the leftists come together." Not long after Hepp was released from prison, other neo-Nazi cadres began attacking NATO installations and discotheques that catered to American servicemen. Two GIs and an Egyptian national were killed in June of 1982 when a neo-Nazi gunman burst into a Nuremberg disco and opened fire on the crowd. Hepp led a gang that unleashed a spate of terror bombings in late 1982 at four U.S. Army bases in West Germany, Eschborn, Darmstadt, Butzbach, and Feckenheim. Initially, it was widely assumed by press and government officials that left-wing terrorists, either the Red Army faction or the revolutionary cells, were behind the bombings, but a police investigation showed otherwise. In February of 1983, three of Hepp's Kameraden were arrested in Frankfurt. According to RAND Corporation analyst Bruce Hoffman, by this time Hepp had escaped to England where he was safe housed by British Nazis. From there, he traveled to Damascus and the Syrian-controlled Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. During this period, according to the French magazine Le Point, Hepp worked with George Habash's Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. His next stop was Tunis, where he earned a salary of $500 a month working for the Abu Abbas group, and then in 1984, he surfaced in France.
For the better part of a year, Hepp circulated among the international terrorist underground in Paris. While in Paris, he had contacts not only with Arab terrorists and neo-Nazi fugitives, but also with indigenous left-wing organizations such as Direct Action, the Belgian-based Communist Combatant Cells, and West Germany's Red Army faction. This far-left trio issued a joint communique in January 1985 announcing the formation of a united, quote, "political military front," unquote, to wage revolutionary war in Europe, with NATO as its principal target. According to Bruce Hoffman, Hepp is suspected of having participated in the 1984 bombing of the Rhein-Main Air Force Base, a U.S. installation in Frankfurt, West Germany. Two U.S. servicemen were wounded in the attack, which has been attributed by the German press to leftists. He is also a suspect in the 1985 bombing of the Marks and Spencer department store in Paris and the Cinema Rivoli Beaubourg, where a Jewish film festival was being shown. Responsibility for the latter attack was claimed by Direct Action. apparently direct action, and its left-wing partners did not fear being manipulated by the likes of Odfried Hepp. In recent years, terrorists have attacked NATO bases and U.S. military personnel in Spain, Portugal, Holland, Italy, Belgium, and Luxembourg, as well as in France and West Germany. Ascertaining who is responsible for these attacks is complicated by the blurring of distinctions between left, far left, and far right. The ultras have much in common psychologically. Both attract impatient, apocalyptic individuals who seek to root deep-rooted wrongs, seek to right deep-rooted wrongs by setting a timer or pulling a trigger. But there are also significant differences between the two extremes. Neo-Nazi terrorists are part of an extensive international network dating back to World War II, a network sustained in part during the Cold War by a U.S. government obsessed with anti-Sovietism. François Jeannot's friends Carl Wolff, Scarface Scorzani, and Klaus Barbie, who spied on leftists for U.S. intelligence in the immediate post-war years and whom the U.S. helped to relocate to Bolivia in 1951, were among the hundreds of Nazis used by the U.S. intelligence after the war.
This last paragraph I'm going to reread because this is one of the most important points, and we haven't had much interpretive discussion. Obviously, we're going to talk a little bit about it once we finished, when we're almost are finished. But there are also significant differences between the two extremes, meaning the ultra-right and the ultra-left. Neo-Nazi terrorists are part of an extensive international network dating back to World War II, a network sustained in part during the Cold War by a U.S. government obsessed with anti-Sovietism. François Jeannot's friends Carl Wolff, Scarface Scorzani, and Klaus Barbie, who spied on leftists for U.S. intelligence in the immediate post-war years and who the U.S. helped to relocate to Bolivia in 1951, were among the hundreds of Nazis used by U.S. intelligence during the war. Western Europe's far-left terrorists, on the other hand, make up tiny cults bereft of grassroots support and are scorned by nearly everyone, especially by the mass left movements in Europe that are committed to social change through nonviolent means. Enfeebled by arrests and informants, Direct Action and other European desperados are more concerned with day-to-day survival than ideological purity. Imprisoned by their own actions, they are living proof of what philosopher George Santayana's axiom, fanaticism consists in redoubling your efforts when you've forgotten your aim, unquote. A report issued by the European Parliament in 1985 cites an alarming growth throughout the continent of racist and xenophobic attitudes which, quote, create a fertile breeding ground for white right-wing extremism, unquote. Disaffected working-class youths, the report noted, are ripe targets for neo-Nazi recruitment, particularly during times of high unemployment and economic recession. That last sentence again also, because this is important. Disaffected working-class youths, the report noted, are ripe targets for neo-Nazi recruitment, particularly during times of high unemployment and economic recession. The danger is exacerbated by the nefarious alliance of the far left and the far right, which presents strategic opportunities for neo-Nazi militants to manipulate authentic desires for peace and self-determination in Europe. And with a rise in neo-Nazi recruitment comes the very real threat of a rise in terrorist activity. The Reagan administration, however, still points to Moscow as terror central, thus giving a green light to the right-wingers who kill innocent civilians and attack U.S. installations. And it may get worse in the days ahead. Those last couple of sentences again, too, I think they apply even more now than they did a year ago. The Reagan administration, however, still points to Moscow as terror central, thus giving a green light to the right-wingers who kill innocent civilians and attack U.S. installations. And it may get worse in the days ahead. The whole of Europe, from Stockholm to Naples, must know about each American who was killed within 48 hours of the event, says Jean Tilliard, a leading Belgian neo-Nazi. European unity will only come about more or less when 200 or 300 American occupiers are killed in every corner of Europe, just to prove our point. There will be no going back. And in an interesting sidebar to this particular article, it's called The Lord of the Books Dealing with French Ultra-Right-Wing Publishing. This, again, by the same authors. Jean-Gilles Malliarkis, M-A-L-L-I-A-R-K-I-S, the self-described Orthodox pagan who heads the MNR, that's the National Revolutionary Movement, apologizes for the lack of a sign on the door, but precautions are necessary. The boisterous MNR youth, who caused a stir last year by carrying a Free Klaus Barbie poster at a public rally, are not exactly the toast of Paris. This obviously is an ultra-right-wing group. We sit down, and Malliarkis proudly shows us his new book, a lengthy denunciation of the Yalta Accords. A burly ex-world-class athlete in his mid-40s, Malliarkas holds both superpowers in contempt. Reagan is a dangerous clown, he declares. America and Russia are the same. Emulating the Italian third position, our host speaks of la troisième voie, the third way that will rescue France from the Atlantic system without becoming a Soviet satellite, unquote. During the hour-long conversation, our eyes darted to the book-lined shelves. Finally, we get a literary tour. One section features such Nazi classics as Mein Kampf. There is a stack of no Holocaust literature highlighted by the works of Robert Faurisson, F-A-U-R-I-S-S-O-N, a French revisionist who denies the existence of Hitler's gas chambers. We also find contributions to this genre published by a tiny, far-left circle in Paris known as the Old Mole Group. There's even a comic book that claims the Holocaust never happened. There are a lot of things that I'm sure Nip and I will comment on about this particular article, because there are a lot of things to be underscored. It should be noted that among the champions of Robert Faurisson among progressive American political circles is none other than Noam Chomsky, the noted author and lecturer. So bear that in mind against the background of the third position.
Indeed, and while we won't spend a great deal of time talking about Noam Chomsky tonight, we did have somebody call while we were taking our musical break and asked for some information, and we have talked about him before. And of course, this is one of the very strange things about Noam Chomsky's career is his support of Robert Faurisson and the use of a Chomsky introduction on one of Faurisson's books. One of the interesting things that I wanted to note, especially because it came from the mouth of a very interesting, very enigmatic man, that being Jacques Vergès, the Paris lawyer that we've, the French lawyer that we've talked about so much tonight. Was Vergès's statement that he had gone through the looking glass and served an apprenticeship. And this was fairly recently after, or fairly soon after, he had first made contact with François Jeannot and the rest of the group. And I was thinking about that, and they mentioned that Jacques Vergès is a chess player and a philosopher and things of this sort. And I was thinking about, of course, the obvious analogy for going through the looking glass is Alice in Wonderland. But I stopped and thought about it, and one of the things that's most significant is when you stand and look at yourself in a looking glass, when you look at something that's like your left hand, for instance, you look at the figure in the mirror, and it appears to be the right hand. That's the interesting thing about looking glasses, is when you've gone through the looking glass, everything that had seemed left before turns out to be right. So maybe Mr. Vergès was giving us a little hint about who exactly he went to serve his apprenticeship.
This on the subject, by the way, of his eight-year disappearance. He simply dropped out of sight for 8 years and then later reappeared. Well, there are a number of things to be ruminated on about the third position of fascism. First of all, this is not a new event in the history of fascism. As we mentioned at the top of the broadcast, the German Nazi Party itself had an explicit wing. Not only was the German Nazi Party called the German National Socialist Workers' Party to attract disaffected left-wingers, but specifically in the early history of the Nazi Party, there was a wing of that party headed by Gregor Strasser, S-T-R-A-S-S-E-R, which was explicitly designed for attracting disaffected left-wingers and which sought a position, although it rejected Marxism per se, they still sought to overthrow, quote, bourgeois society. Beyond that, I think it's quite clear from the text of Coogan and Lee's article that the third position fascists today obviously play very nicely into the hands of the exponents of the strategy of tension in the various parts of the world where they are putting that into practice. Not only Italy, but as we looked at in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal in Radio Free America shows 32 and 34, the strategy of tension appears to have been one of the things that Oliver North and company may have been intending to use with regard to precipitating war in Central America, using the Lapenca bombing and the proposed bomb assassination of U.S. Ambassador to Costa Rica, Louis Tams, but also quite possibly precipitating fascism and martial law in the United States under the Rex 84 martial law plan. Recall earlier the connection between Oliver North, the alleged target of Abu Nidal's and Gaddafi's terrorist moves of the past week, and the connection again between Abu Nidal, Abu Abbas, whose group hijacked the Achille Lauro and who was hooked up with Otfried Hepp, the German neo-Nazi who was one of the prisoners to be exchanged for the Achille Lauro people, and their connections with Manzer El-Kassar and Oliver North. Again, it's an interesting thing to contemplate. Those who would like to use the strategy of tension, as Stefano Della Chiaia dubbed it, basically the old strategy of provocation, setting up a terrorist incident, blaming it on your opponent, and using it to justify either military expansionism abroad or a crackdown on civil liberties at home, Even though the neo-Nazis themselves may have been right-wing, their anti-American and violently anti-American sentiments and their willingness to merge themselves with people like Direct Action, PLO, PFLP, and others obviously fits very, very nicely into the strategy of tension. And in Radio Free America show number 19, we took a look at the ambiguity of Italian terrorism in which the right-wing P2 and the Secret Services were manipulating terror of both the right and left, often giving prospective terrorists their choice of which side of the fence they chose to work.
Yes, the phrase that often is used and that springs time to time again to mind is useful idiots. It's nice to have sincere believers who think that they're striking a blow to direct instigation, although they may not know it of that same imperialist overculture.
It's also interesting to reflect on efforts by the far right in this country to penetrate more progressive organizations. Again, the Camp Hobbit, the organic food, the ecological concerns, the views on women's rights and so forth, while admirable in and of themselves, should be viewed here more the way one would look at an SS platoon putting camouflage uniforms and pieces of brush in their helmets. They may look like they're going to blend in with the surroundings. They may look very greened, in fact. However, that is not a very good indication to their social attitudes.
That's right. Green is also the color of putrescence. We're going to take a break on that pleasant thought, and we are going to come back and take your telephone call.